Frontline correspondent A.C. Thompson began documenting hate crimes after the 2016 election. He could tell that the Charlottesville rally, billed as a response to the removal of a Confederate monument, was about much more than a single statue. He was there, and his latest project is Documenting Hate, Charlottesville. It was made in collaboration with ProPublica, and it exposes the white supremacists and neo-Nazis involved in the Charlottesville rally. It shows how some of those behind the racist violence went unchecked and continued to operate around the country. This joint investigation premieres tonight at 10, 9 Central on PBS stations and online at pbs.org/frontline. And you could read related reporting, I'm very anxious about this, at ProPublica.org, and it brings A.C. Thompson to our show. A.C., welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Listen, you said that the Charlottesville rally, even before it started, felt like a national reckoning around race. That's your quote. What was it about the buildup to that rally that made you feel like it was going to be special?
You know, I had been watching the chatter online for months. I've been watching what people were discussing online, and I thought, this is going to be a big event. This is going to be significant. And already in the months leading up to that, we had seen 3 people stabbed at a Klan rally in Anaheim. We'd seen 7 people stabbed at a Nazi event in Sacramento. We had seen 2 incredibly violent protests in the city of Berkeley, California. And now all the neo-Nazis, the white supremacists, those types were talking, this is going to be bigger. This is going to be more extreme than that.
All right, I'm a black woman. I'm an African-American. And a basic question I've always wondered about, and maybe you can help me understand this, what is motivating all of this white grievance, this anger? What's at the root of the we don't like brown people or we don't like anything different than us mindset?
You know, what I can tell you is what people tell me in those movements. And they say, we're worried about becoming minorities in our own country. We see that there are more and more brown folks moving to America. The demographic changes scare us. And some of them are very, very truthful, I think. And they say, look, we realize that minorities have been badly treated in this country. We realize that people of color have been badly treated in this country. And we don't want that to happen to us. And I think that is one of the key sort of drivers, is this sort of feeling that that as the demography changes, that they'll be left behind, marginalized, and eventually stomped on.
Do you think that there's a basic, not understanding of, American history? Do people not know how this country started, how it was a nation that was filled with brown people, Native Americans? And is that a part of what the problem might also be?
No, I actually think it's different than that. I actually think, when you talk to these folks, they say, white people conquered this land. That was a good thing to do. We suppressed the savages and exterminated them, and we are civilized people who took over an uncivilized savage land.
Man.
So it's different than that.
Whoa, that's pretty deep.
Yeah,
that is deep. What were you hoping to learn by attending these rallies?
You know,
this particular one,
I wanted to understand where this movement was going and what was propelling it, and where we might end up. I had seen for a long time this sort of resurgence of ideas and groups and activism that had largely died out in the 90s. Mm-hmm. After Tim McVeigh blew up the Oklahoma City Federal Building in 1995, a lot of this sort of dropped off. And the white power activism really sort of dissipated after that. And here it was making this resurgence. And I wanted to understand, what were these people doing, and where did they want to end up? And that was really why we started following them. But also, in places like Berkeley and Charlottesville and other places throughout the country, we realized, hey, some of these actors, some of these figures who have been out at these events have engaged in really dubious, if not criminal, conduct, and they have not been held to account. And so we want to know, who are these people, and how is it possible that you can commit what looks to be a string of crimes on video, brag about it, post about it, circulate that video, and then not be held to account.
And not be held to account. You do track a few people and name them. And it's interesting to me, since they're not afraid to be on video and they're not afraid to take part in these actions. But then when you found one in particular and you confronted him on his way to work, the gentleman who worked for Grumman, they don't really want to be known. That's when they sort of back off.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. It's like this sort of like social media celebrity where I'm going to be online and I'm going to have a mask on or have my identity obscured some way and brag about the violence that I've engaged in. But then when you get into real life and we're talking to you face to face without a mask, it becomes a different situation.
Isn't that also an interesting dynamic, that the face to face aspect of trying to talk through these grievances or whatnot, that's not part of how they roll. It's this mass attack, this masked and group kind of thuggery that goes on, not any kind of real engagement with other people.
Right. You know, the sense I get is that people spend time online. They spend time in these circles online where sort of beliefs are reinforced without a lot of outside input. And so this sort of the culture of white grievance gets reinforced and reinforced and reinforced. And then pretty soon you step into the real world and you're looking at anyone that you think is causing you this harm as your mortal enemy. Right. And there hasn't been anyone sort of intervening intellectually to say, hey, you know, maybe that's not the way to be thinking about this.
Yeah, that thought doesn't even occur to them. I'm Nancy Giles, and I'm speaking with Frontline correspondent A.C. Thompson about the film Documenting Hate, Charlottesville, which is made in collaboration with ProPublica. It's going to be on Frontline tonight at 10, 9 Central on PBS stations across the country. It's an incredible piece of work. And they say the Charlottesville rally was the largest gathering of white supremacists in a generation. About how many attended that Unite the Right group?
You know, it's still debated how many folks were there. People put it anywhere from 500 to 1,000 on the second day.
Wow.
On Saturday. And I think people are still debating how many were there.
Now, what's interesting is they had that little mini protest, that sort of preview the night before with the tiki torches, which I would think would have been an indication to law enforcement that trouble might be on the horizon. I mean, more people than they thought were going to be. Where were the police? Why weren't they taking that lead?
That's a really great question. So after the events in Charlottesville, the city commissioned a independent report. It's called the Hafey Report. It's about 200 pages long. And in it, the investigators say, hey, exactly that. Friday night was bad. It was violent. It was not responded to well by the police, and they didn't prepare for it well. And Friday night was basically about the university police, because that happened on the campus, on the grounds of the University of Virginia.
And you were there.
I was there.
And it was very, very quiet for the longest time. And then they just kind of showed up.
Right. And to us, my colleague said, hey, I don't know if anyone's going to show up. I don't know if this is going to happen. And then suddenly, like in a matter of moments, hundreds of people came in tight groups, mobilized by commanders who were giving them orders and directing them, and queued up and were ready to go. It was quite impressive in terms of organization. But the investigators, as they looked at this in the aftermath, they said, look, what happened on Friday night set the tone for the rest of the weekend. And nobody seemed to pick up on the lessons of Friday night, which was that if you don't check violence, if you don't intervene and keep people from wilding out on one another, then bad things are going to happen. And the report was very, very critical of that sort of failure to take action immediately on Friday night. And then the failure to sort of learn the lesson from Friday night and apply it to Saturday.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, were the police conscious of what they were doing, or were they just trying to downplay it, thinking if they downplayed it, maybe it would downplay the event? Because it doesn't make sense.
You know, I don't know, and I don't think we have clarity about exactly why, particularly Friday night, happened.
Yeah.
Now, the investigators have said, on when it comes to Saturday, the big day, when things got really worse and got fatal.
Fatal.
That there were a whole slew of problems. And it goes back to planning, right? The Virginia State Police mobilized 600 officers.
Okay.
The city of Charlottesville had a smaller number of officers. The National Guard was there with hundreds of soldiers. And yet these groups didn't seem to know what the other were doing.
They weren't communicating
with
each other.
They weren't coordinated. as I understand it, the Virginia State Police and Charlottesville Police didn't share operational plans.
Oh, dear.
They couldn't talk to one another on the radio, just like we saw in 9/11 so many years ago.
Oh, my gosh.
And at times there were these sort of like really key breakdowns, like the people who were supposed to don riot gear in the event that there was a riot, which was likely. That riot gear wasn't near the site of the park where all the events were happening.
Wait a minute. What? The actual gear that they needed wasn't nearby.
Right. The shields, the helmets, all that. And so they didn't have easy access to it.
Someone forget to swing by and pick up the riot gear? I mean, that's bizarre.
As I understand it, it was a planning mistake that it was put away from the site. And then later folks said, oh, that wasn't what we wanted to do.
So what's especially chilling about this piece, I think, is you have this minute-to-minute kind of coverage of what happened that day. And there's actual footage from one of the people that was attacked, Emily Gorsensky, an anti-racist protester. She had a phone that was able to show her being set upon by these people.
Right. And that was I remember seeing her there that night. But when it actually came to that melee, it all happened so fast and was so intense that I couldn't follow everything that was happening. And later when we went back and we looked at the footage, it was really chilling. What you saw was white supremacists with torches that were aflame beating their opponents in the head over and over again. And when you really saw it and you slowed down the footage, it's really, really disturbing.
It's chilling. I mean, and you see the looks on some of their faces. By the way, some of them weren't even wearing masks.
Right. That night, most people were not wearing masks. By the next day, a lot of people had masked up and they were wearing sort of more combat gear. So helmets, shields, all that kind of stuff.
To protect themselves from, but while they were still causing damage. AC, do you think that the lack of a response by the police on Friday night helped to empower the rioters, the Nazi rioters the next day? Because, I mean, if the police, if they got a green light that they weren't going to get any problem from them, did that make them feel like we can go a step further?
Well, I was there and I've interviewed many, many people about this, but I'll tell you, the investigators who did the Charlottesville report, who interviewed even more people than I did, that is their feeling. They say, look, the violence that night emboldened folks the next day to go out and cause harm. And they said, anybody who was there or saw video from the University of Virginia and wanted to engage in violence would have been heartened by what they saw and the lack of police response. That's their assessment.
Wow. And there were people on the side, the protesters to the white supremacists, they were saying, screaming, police, we need your help. Yeah. Where are you?
Right.
Without getting any kind of intervention. I mean, there's a young man that was beaten by, DeAndre Harris, who was surrounded and beaten. And you see footage of people screaming, where are the police? And police standing there.
Right. And so the Charlottesville police had officers right next to the place where that occurred in the parking garage. And according to our reporting and according to the independent investigation, those officers didn't enter the parking garage to intervene and break that up until the county sheriff went into the garage himself, and then they followed him in.
Was that another thing of waiting for, you know, to know what the right thing to do was, or?
You know, as I understand it, it sounded like they felt like they were not prepared to go in there and that they didn't have the tools that they needed. But I'm not entirely sure why that happened, and I think that kind of still remains a question.
What's so sad is that a young woman was killed. A young woman was actually murdered. Heather
Heyer.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you the thing, I was just writing about this. I remember being there on 4th Street and seeing bodies all over the place.
My goodness.
And the reason we weren't there when it actually happened is because my colleague and I were with those counter protesters at the park where they had converged, and they had just started to march out into the streets. Peacefully. And I said, hey, do you want to follow these folks? And he said, no, we've been working nonstop for a long time. Let's sit here and do a couple interviews. And a few minutes later, that attack happened. Here's the thing. When it happened, I felt horrified. I felt saddened. I felt sick to my stomach. And I did not feel surprised. No, I felt like this was going to happen because the violence had been escalating, not just that weekend, but for months and months before that. And I said, I have not seen a lot of capacity or desire from the police here to intervene and tamp this down. And that's what happens. That's what happens. And so to me, it was like the sort of lack of surprise was really sad.
What a feeling that must have been. Oh, I'm Nancy Giles. I'm speaking with Frontline correspondent A.C. Thompson about the film documenting Hate Charlottesville, made in collaboration with ProPublica. I'm Nancy Giles. I'm speaking with Frontline correspondent A.C. Thompson about the film documenting Hate Charlottesville, made in collaboration with ProPublica. This is going to be airing on PBS Frontline tonight at 10, 9 Central Time. And you can see it on PBS stations, as I said, and online at pbs.org/frontline. A.C., can you talk to me a little bit about how the ideology of the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists kind of overlap? Where do those two hate groups come together?
You know, that's a great question, because when I talk to folks, a lot of times they think all these folks are the same, that all these groups, all these ideologies are the same, and they're actually different. So what we have these days operating in the U.S. are, we have neo-Nazis who are really directly linking their movement to the Third Reich, and they want to emulate the Third Reich. They are different, I would say, than, for example, the Klan, who still exist in small numbers, greatly diminished, and we're out in Charlottesville. The Klan are basically like white Southern revivalists, right? They're a different deal. Okay. Then you have the sort of the alt-right and these groups that have sprung up in the last few years, who have what you would say is a very fascist or fascist-like ideology, but may not use the Nazi iconography and may not think of themselves in those terms.
Okay.
And you have all these sort of different permutations of this, and they're all slightly different, but they all, I think, are similar in that they're based around this notion that the best way forward for white people in this country is to have a country with nobody but whites. And they would put Jews in that category as well and say, get rid of all the Jews.
Oh, they would. Jews aren't white in their book.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And I think that's the sort of shared value. Some of these people will say, look, I'm not a white supremacist. I don't think whites are the most successful, the smartest, the top of the human food chain. I don't believe that. But they'll say, but I do believe that we should be separate from everyone else.
And do they say why? Because why?
There is a belief amongst these folks that diversity, that cultural, ethnic, racial, religious diversity is an affliction. That it is that homogenous societies, that societies where everyone is basically the same, where they think the same, where they go to the same church, where they believe the same things, and they have the same hues of skin, that is the ideal society. And
right.
That once you start breaking that up, and once you have a society that is actually the way just about every society looks now, that is diverse and brings people from all different places to live in one country, that then things start breaking down and that society starts collapsing. And that is one of the sort of key ideas.
It must be hard for them to even enjoy the soccer, because the World Cup was won by France and the team that was mostly Africans that lived in France. I mean, I wonder how that went down with that group.
Right. You know, what's interesting about these folks is the earlier generations of white power activists, they were so humorless and they were so serious that they couldn't watch Hollywood movies because they'd say, look, there's so many Jews operating in Hollywood. This is just propaganda.
Man.
They couldn't watch sports because obviously there's a lot of people of color in sports, as you just noted. They couldn't get into sort of any popular culture and be connected to mainstream culture because of this. The younger activists, what they do is they take what they like from popular culture and use it to their own ends. And they don't.
In what way? Can you give me an example?
Yeah, exactly. So Bane, the Batman anti-hero, becomes one of their heroes and one of their sort of icons, right? So they have just repurposed him for their movement. When you talk about sports, they'll look at a guy like Conor McGregor, the Irish MMA fighter, and he will be their great white hope.
I see.
And they'll sort of attach themselves to that. And they'll hope that he wins, but they can watch these sort of cultural events and sporting events and be tied into it. And they're also, you know, very tied into internet culture and plugged into gamer culture, social media culture, and all of that in a way that their predecessors weren't. And in part because that stuff didn't exist, but in part because they were also just sort of disconnected.
Well, also the internet is a great resource for really polarized views. You can really link into people who are exactly like you without any disturbance from anybody else.
Right. Like reading through these hundreds of thousands of chat logs that I've done of these groups, the discussions in there are arcane. They're about minutiae, but they're about, like, you know, minor ideological differences, but they're not about big questions. They're not about, like, being massively different than someone else. It's about very small things. So there's definitely reinforcing groupthink.
AC, you include in the film that infamous Trump response to the violence where he said, you know, you had one group on one side that was bad. You had another group that was also very violent. And, you know, he really did fan those flames. Can you talk a little bit about how that moment also was a complete green light to white supremacists and Nazi sympathizers across the country that we've got somebody in our corner now?
What you had been seeing for months with people who are active in the white supremacist movement is when the president and first, the campaigning candidate, Donald Trump, would say something they agreed with. Again, they would take that as a green light. They'd take it as a sign. He agrees with us. He supports our mission. He's on our side. And what was novel about 2016 is it had been many years since the organized white supremacist groups got behind a major political candidate.
Right.
They generally stayed away from that and said, you know, both of these candidates, Democrats, Republicans, whoever, they're part of the system. They
certainly
don't,
not
they don't
the presidential candidates.
Absolutely.
I mean, on a smaller scale, like
right.
David Duke ran for
right.
office and whatnot, but we'd never seen anything like that before.
Exactly. Like, they viewed Republicans and Democrats as both part of the same corrupt system that was multicultural. They believed controlled by the Jews, etc. And then when you had Trump, it was a different thing. It was a different thing. They said, hey, we don't agree with him on everything. And the president will say, I'm not racist. I'm the least racist person you meet.
You always worry about someone who says something like that. But
right.
anyway.
But they would say, you know, we agree with him on a lot of things. And we're excited that someone who shares a lot of our values seems to be headed for office. So it was a very different thing.
The mayor of Charlottesville, who is a Democrat, Michael Signer, was really, really shocked by what he heard. How did he feel about what was happening to his city?
He was really pained. I mean, profoundly pained. And I, like I say in the film, I saw him and I saw the other city officials and I saw the governor that night at the city, at the county government headquarters. And to get into the county government headquarters, you had to go through a raft of fully armed police in body armor,
they had
rifles,
the body armor,
helmets,
right.
everything else inside the building, outside
Whoa.
And inside. It
Whoa.
Was like a war zone. And I looked at then Mayor Mike Signer. I looked at Governor McAuliffe. I looked at City Councilman Wes Bellamy. I looked at all these people, and it was like we have stepped into the dystopia we had so greatly feared. Like we were in a dystopian science fiction novel where the culture has gone to war against itself.
Oh my goodness, that must have been so painful for them.
I think so.
I mean, and also just on the local level to be living the something that actually our president did not help, you know, that he could lay down that kind of racist rhetoric and hear the fruits of that they're dealing with.
Right.
Oh man, I've got to ask you the mother of
Heather Heyer,
you spoke with her as well. Does she feel like enough people that were responsible for her daughter's murder have been charged? There's only been one person charged with her daughter's death.
You know, we had a really interesting talk about what justice for her daughter would look like. And one of the points she made is, look, people came from 35 states to engage in this violence, and very few of them have been held accountable. And that is a good point to make. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I think she said this thing to me that moves me, and if I'll be careful because I'll start tearing up. But she said, it was just so simple, but it was so resonant. She said, life without Heather is very different now. And it wasn't like, and that's the thing that you realize, you lose someone. And it's not just the sadness and the pain. It's that suddenly everything is different. And it was very, very moving to me.
Yeah. I mean, her daughter's dead. Her daughter died at the hands of this kind of chaos, this organized chaos. I was very moved by that as well. What solutions do you think can prevent something like this? I don't know about preventing, but what can we do? What can we learn from what happened in Charlottesville?
So the first thing is the operational sort of nuts and bolts thing. And I think we've seen generally improved policing and awareness from both federal law enforcement and local law enforcement since this, because nobody else really wants to have another Charlottesville in their town. So that has happened to a certain extent. But I think more broadly, I think you're asking a broader, bigger question. And I think, look, we are not getting from the top a lot of statements about overcoming divisiveness, about fighting racism, about fighting all these other phobias and isms we're afflicted with. And so perhaps it's up to civil society, it's up to people in the street to be the ones that say, we are going to live in a harmonious, tolerant, diverse society. And there's no way around it, because we're mm-hmm. not going back. We're not going to change.
No.
So perhaps it really is up to us as journalists and up to the citizens and activists and residents in the street to say, you know, if the tone doesn't come from the top, we will set the tone.
That we, each person can make a difference. We've gotten some calls from people asking questions. A caller is asking, because they have open carry in that state, there were so many guns, they were surprised that there wasn't any gunfire.
Yeah, there actually was gunfire.
There was
at least one shooting incident that involved a Klansman who fired off his gun. And that was the thing, when you were there, what was terrifying is everybody is armed.
Open carry.
Yes, and what I expected was what the caller is suggesting is like a full-on gun battle.
And there wasn't.
There wasn't. So we can feel lucky about that.
Thank God. A gentleman named Russ from Long Island is wondering about the permits given by Charlottesville City Council. I mean, did permits have stipulations about what could happen in the march? And has the city council been taken to task for giving permits for the march in the first place?
So, you know, this was the subject of litigation. It went to federal court. The ACLU represented the march organizers, the rally organizers. So there was a lot of back and forth about this. I think one of the key lessons that has been learned is, hey, in Virginia, you cannot bar people from bringing their weapons to an event like that. They're guns. But you can prevent them from bringing knives, bats, clubs, pepper spray, helmets, shields, and the rest. And I think that was something that folks didn't quite understand at the time.
Right.
And city officials there and other places now do understand better.
But they did have those things. They used those kinds of weapons.
Yeah, so they should have said, hey, there's a protest zone. If you want to come in the protest zone, check your weapons at the door. We can't actually keep the guns out, but we can keep the rest of this stuff out.
Yeah, they could have done that. The beating of DeAndre Harris, I think are there four people that are being held in relation to that? Four people charged?
Four people have been adjudicated, as I understand it.
What other changes can you suggest that in Charlottesville, maybe that this kind of rally situation or anywhere does not happen again?
You know, the key sort of thing is really what we had seen for years before that. 50 years ago, people got sick of the Klan marching on their towns. They got sick of Illinois Nazis marching through their town.
That's right.
And they have encountered very intense resistance for a long time. And for a long time, police understood there are going to be rival factions here. They will not like each other. They need to be kept apart.
Right.
And it wasn't that, you know, it wasn't that.
It was a no-brainer.
Right, right. And I think we want to see police behave in humane ways. We want them to see them limit physical force where possible. But I also think it's pretty simple to say, like, hey, you need to keep these two sides apart from one another in these highly charged moments so that you don't have political warfare spilling out onto the street.
And in case, like the case of Charlottesville, you've got different modes of police, the state, the feds, they need to coordinate. I mean, right. that's an easy fix right there.
Absolutely, absolutely. That they need to one, take the intelligence briefings they get ahead of time seriously. They need to make sure they're getting good intelligence. They need to then devise operational plans where they're working together. If you've got multiple agencies, and typically at these events you do, you'll have, you know, a city or a county agency working with mutual aid from other local agencies or state agencies. So yes, they need to coordinate.
This is just a moment in the film that I want to go back to because I found it so interesting. When you track down that one particular rioter that worked for Grumman. Mm. I'm not sure if that's the gentleman who also had a military background or if that's another.
Different guys. There's two different military guys.
Military guy and that guy. Yeah. And when you said to him, you very calmly said who you were, and you also said, you know, we have film of you, and he was just like, oh, no, that's not me. You've got me mistaken and whatnot. So why are these guys so cowardly? Why is it that and in his case, he wasn't even covered in a lot of the in a lot of the tape that you have. And it was clear that that was him. Why not admit it? Of course, he's going to pay the price. He lost his job. But why are they proud to be part of this crowd and not proud to stand up face to face and talk to you about why?
You know, I can't speculate too much about...
What's your feeling about it?
I think in the case of some of these people, if you have been on video, in photos, engaging in what appears to be criminal activity, that there perhaps is a concern that you will end up being held to account at some point. And that's one of the things that I can speculate would be why you didn't want to say, yeah, I was there and I did that. That would be, I think, the simplest, most obvious sort of answer to me.
Right.
And also that, you know, there's a lot of people, I would say probably more than response from law enforcement in the aftermath of these events, there has been a lot of public unhappiness with many of the participants. And I think that may be something that some of them are concerned about in revealing their identities.
Well, what's interesting about that is, of course, their actions would bring about that kind of thing. So I don't, again, that disconnect between participating in something like that and then what the ramifications, what you know, the consequences of that, there seems to be a gap.
Right, right. What happened after Charlottesville is things went in sort of a few different directions. And mm-hmm. there were people who said, I don't want to be involved in this movement anymore. And there's people, I've been contacted
that's
by people
good.
Who said, hey, you know, I thought I was a racist and I figured out I'm not. And that's pretty interesting. And there's people who said, look, the toll is too high. Like, I may get killed, I may get arrested. I just don't want to be involved. Other people said, look, what we're going to do, and you've seen this in New York with a group called Identity Europa. Mm-hmm. So they said, we're not going to do organized big events where everyone will show up and oppose us. We're going to do hit and run guerrilla style politics, like banner drops, posters, show up at the Mexican consulate unannounced and do something and then bail.
Right.
And then the third group of people has said, we're just going to do terrorism. That's what we're going to do.
Oh, man. And the gap between what they're doing and terrorism is just not that big a gap. Thank you so much for joining me. This is Nancy Giles. I've been speaking with Frontline correspondent A.C. Thompson about the film Documenting Hate, Charlottesville, made in collaboration with ProPublica. Documenting Hate airs tonight at 10 on PBS. We should also note that WNYC's newsroom is a partner in the Documenting Hate project. Reporters Matt Katz and Arun Venugopal have been contributing pieces, along with the WNYC Data News team. And you can find their reporting on WNYC.org.